You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking to Russell Cain, fabulous comedian, absolute ball of energy, and also really committed to being the toughest kid on the estate when it comes to getting laughs. We're going to talk about Russell's place in the comedy firmament, or certainly his idea of his place. We'll talk about the creative power of his energy on stage, and we'll talk about his perhaps surprising reaction to Stuart Lee's material about him, as well as learning about the hour-long preview, which he scripted in just 8 words, moments before walking on stage. If you'd care to join the Insiders Club, or if you're already a member, and if you're not, you can sign up at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. You get 25 minutes of extra content, including Russell's amazing advice for comics considering performing live stand-up on YouTube, for which there isn't really a name, but live stand-up on YouTube. It's a thing he does. You can search for caning on YouTube if you'd like to see some of those. And thoughts on his possible overcommitment to showing one particular critic who was boss. That's all at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Here is the very funny Russell Cain. Let's start with some of your material. The last time I saw you live was at the Apollo, I think, and you were doing a bit of material about, it really stuck with me, because it was kind of about parenthood, but it wasn't specific to parenthood. It was a really good example of something you do really well, which is to find like the bones of an idea, zoom out from it and make it universal, and then zoom back into it and find the funnies in it. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think the bit of material was about phases in your life and the fact that everyone goes through this process of going, this is a phase in my life that I'm in right now and I'm happy and I'm settled, but I want something else. And then going for the next thing, whether that's a house or a job change or a family or what have you. And do you know the bit I mean?
Yeah, it's actually about the illusion of keep thinking, oh, I'm grown up now. So this is the main adult bit. You know, the main bit of the sandwich is obviously aged 30 to 60. That's the main sandwich bit of adulthood where you raise, this is the after bit is the crappy after party where you've got osteoporosis and you're coming down. The before bit is where you're just biting into the drugs. But the 30 to 60, that's the meat of the rave. And of course, it's bullshit because that's what you believed. If you can remember your 11th birthday, I can, or my 10th birthday. I remember getting into double digits and having a 10th birthday. I couldn't believe my age was made of 2 digits. And I thought, well, that's the baby bit out of the way. You know, I feel grown up now. And then you get to a teenager, you go, I can't believe I thought 10 was grown up. This is the real shit I've got to deal with. And on and on. And I think life advances, not in, people say, but it's just slow increments. You don't feel yourself aging. It's these slow increments. Before you knew it, you're old. That's what you think when you look back. But if you actually look back more closely, it's a mixture, much like, who's the scientific theorist that did it? It's either Thomas Kuhn or Karl Popper. Science advances with a combination of, yes, slow evolution with slow tweaking of Newtonian laws, slow tweaking, followed by, boom, Einstein, massive revolution, slow tweaking of Einsteinian laws.
Okay.
That is losing your virginity. That is going to university. That is getting married. That is your first kid being born. That's your kid going to secondary school. That's your kid leaving home. That's you retiring. That's you going into the nursing home. And that's you dying. So there's these little leaps onto different cliffs, which feel slow, But in fact, there's always another cliff to go, except we just don't know what's beyond the last one. That's where religious people and non-religious people part ways.
So when writing that bit of material, had you done the reading beforehand and thought, I like that idea and I can express it in a funny way? Or did it kind of percolate from having read it years ago? Or do you now look at having stumbled upon that idea and now go, oh, yeah, that's a parallel with that bit of Popper?
So this is where I do have to be careful, because it makes me really unpopular with comedians every time I say this. it's my broad opinion that there's, very roughly speaking, two types of comic.
Go on.
The genius craftsman writer whose thoughts will be here long after you and I are dead, and whose Wikipedia page will still be visited. People who actually leave something in the atmosphere. Frankie Boyle, Stuart Lee, on a mainstream level, Michael McIntyre, brilliant observations. People like that, that have actual bits that you can't wait to go to the pub and talk about. Then there's the other group of people. I think maybe even Lee Mack does both a little bit, but he's probably the head of this group. I'm in this group, who just a funny person who one day thinks, shit, I can monetize this stuff I'm already saying to my mates, and picked up a microphone. I have never, touch wood, to this day, written any stand-up down ever. Or what I do is, every time something funny happens to me, or if some minute my daughter did something funny, or Lindsay says something funny, or if I make my mother-in-law laugh at dinner, who we're in a childcare support bubble with, recording this during lockdown 3.0, I quickly write in my notes, made Yvonne laugh about talcum powder. That is all I will take on stage if for the preview. Bullet point, Yvonne talcum powder routine. So my first 60-minute preview probably has about 10 bullet points on it, no more than 200 words. And then I quickly tell those stories in whatever words come into my head and advance, just to, sorry to reuse the same metaphor twice, to advance in a Darwinian way, keeping the funny bits. That's why I do so many more previews than almost everyone I know. I do 40 or 50 before my first gig, because I just keep finding the funny in that. So I'd start with my pub story, and then I'd drop the bit that isn't universally funny. So that answers your question about how I find the universal, is that it's a basic glitter clad whore looking for where the laughs are found in the majority of people in a mainstream audience. And that routine in particular was a bridging bit between talking about getting married. And one day I said, oh, you think you're going to get married and you think you've completed, and there's another level to go called leaving the honeymoon period. It got a massive laugh. So the next night I added another layer, and it grew like that over four nights. And then I added long words to it and thoughts, and it sounds really profound. That's how it was built.
That way, that's a great answer, thank you. That way that you are sort of casually dismissive of your ability, like that you kind of naturally place yourself in... Do you know what I mean?
The ability can be superior. In my opinion, for what it's worth, Lee Mack is one of my top three funny people in the country, if we're using funny in its proper sense. But people, like your posh critics and everything, would want to stick other things in the funny box. Quite rightly, one of the best shows I've watched in the last 3 years is Nanette Hannah Gadsby. If you were lucky enough to see it live, I'm very envious if not watch it on Netflix. But they're different things, really. One's an amazing piece of stand-up, brilliantly written, that we'll probably be watching in 100 years. And the other is your funny mate who will make you piss your pants laughing. I wanted to be the second one. I still want to be the second one. That's what I was born to do. I just love arsing around and being funny. I don't have any other skills apart from writing commercial writing and fiction, which I like doing, but I can't really do that for a living. I tried. It's purely... If I was at the side of the stage and me and you were messing around and someone else was hosting and I had a sandwich that had gone off and we were joking about it, I probably would talk about that sandwich when I went on, and it might go on for ages.
Okay. So,
but not with the Ross Noble surreal freewheeling, with the instant kind of looking for the universal observation.
Yes. Oh, sorry. So not with the freeling, but more with the what is it about that sandwich
I wouldn't go
with
this
sandwich.
Imagine if the sandwich was a tent and we were inside, and the cucumber was a massive fucking window. Yeah. I would just go, what is it we've gone off food? Why can some people tolerate it? And then my brain would be like, oh, yeah, people that never shit themselves when they get food poisoning. I probably would make fun of you. Which one out of you two doesn't get ill? And I'd be off down that tangent, looking for the universal black and white them and us belly laugh out of the sandwich riff we were doing at the side of the stage. I'm the luckiest, laziest, right? I'll never forget, I won't say which comedian it was, very, very, very good comedian. We were sharing a preview slot where one had the first hour, one had the second hour, and he was on his 10th preview. I was on my first for that Edinburgh. I think it was June, so I was behind. And he went on first, so I could come up with 60 minutes at the side of the stage. So, and that year I got nominated for the Perrier. But anyway, I didn't come up with the 60 minutes. I just went through my notebook, looked for 8 funny stories. Mm-hmm. And then because of my previous life working in advertising, I'm really good at putting a pseudo structure and a net over it. Today's show's about stereotypes and myths. I just said a pretentious sentence like that and everyone believes it. And of course, if you say the word... If the word stereotypes and myths, anything in stand-up is stereotype. Oh, first of all, I want to explore the stereotypes of men versus women. Next, I want to explore the stereotypes of Brits abroad. You know, so what I mean? It fits. You name me a routine, I will fit that concept mm-hmm. to it. And I've done that with every one of my shows without a critic spotting a single time. Too late now, I've got all the trophies.
You've mentioned critics twice. And I feel like there might be a bit of a... I'm interested in kind of digging into your feelings about the critical reception of your work. Because I wonder yes. whether... I think we all start off thinking, you know, the very first brilliant gig you have, I think we all think, I can be anything. I can be the best. Right, of course. We're sort of like, oh my God, I have access to this world. I can participate in this and I can potentially excel at this. And I think along the way... We're all subject to pressures from outside critics, agents, the industry, the idea of the industry, our peers doing better or worse or whatever. And that kind of molds our apprehension of what our career is going to be. And I wonder the extent to which, like, when did you first kind of solidify that notion that there are the people who will stand the test of time and then the kind of funny fuck about people like me? Like, did you always think that?
I never realized I had an unusual... I never realised that's an unusually quick writing process until people told me. Because to me, it's the easiest thing in the world. If you go into Sainsbury's, point at an aisle and pick a product, and then I can come around the corner 5 minutes later and do not just a joke about it, but probably some sort of observation. If it's food, it'll be about keto food. If it's pet food, I'll do something about cats. But that's just like a... I don't think I'm on a spectrum of any kind because I don't have any problem with eye contact or emotions, but it's just a way. It did serve me really well in the job I was doing before I did stand-up advertising, and that someone can go, it's a chocolate bar. We've got Bradley Walsh and his son. It's a chocolate bar, Cadbury's. What's the campaign going to be? We need to launch Dairy Milk. I would go around to the brainstorm area and I'd sit in there for 2 days, whereas I already had the solution after an hour. And then I would bill lots of hours and then come out with, oh, it's stressful, here's 100. And there'd be like all paper over the wall, but I knew in the middle was the killer idea. I can just think of joke, like the way... It's weird, isn't it, that we have to be embarrassed about it. If I was a in physics or in maths or an engineer... or I was an artist and was able to sketch a face quickly, I wouldn't have to hide it. But because of what we do, we have to go on stage and show off to be funny. There's an inbuilt arrogance in saying I'm really quick at thinking up the ideas that you know you're going to be judged for when other comedians see it. I'm not worried about audiences hearing it. They'll think, oh, Russell's really quick at comedy, let's go and see him. But that's just, I quickly realised, though, going to Edinburgh over and over again, that there was a difference the way the critics reviewed shows. They didn't really care about how funny things were. They cared about how innovatively funny they were. And I've never agreed with that, ever. People won't laugh if the idea is hackneyed and too recognised. So people need to stop disappearing up their bum holes, declaring an idea cliched and hackneyed if a room of 1,000 people don't believe it. So it's just that you've overstudied it till you've ruined it by looking at it.
I definitely agree with the second half of that, overstudying stuff, you can ruin it, of course. But I wonder, have you never seen a comedian get a big laugh off something you knew to be, you know, I mean, I don't like using the word hack, but something that has, you know, a tired observation, a well-worn path? We've all seen comics get big laughs off those, surely.
Yeah, I've seen comedians get big laughs off something I, Russell Cain, believe to be a well-worn path and have then learned it's not that well-worn if it can make 1,000 people laugh with surprise.
But is that laugh always surprise or is that laugh simply satisfaction at them going, yes, that's true?
I don't think jokes can work like that. I think there needs to be an element. Unless someone's coming to see the exact same routine by the same comic, the way you might rewind like a Peter Kay Netflix thing, or to go, I love this routine and watch it with your mates. Yes. But if someone comes to see me do a routine about COVID-19, and I wrote a COVID show last year, and I managed to perform it about 50 times in that short summer that we had. But, you know, straight, I could see all the comedians that went before me. I was thinking, oh, none of them have got anything that's like anything I'm about to say. So my stuff popped more.
Yeah.
It just does. Whereas if those acts who've been listening to all that stuff and looking at all the funny TikToks and looking at all the blogs, if I go on stage and it's well-worn, it just won't surprise as much. You won't get the, that's so true, why have I never thought of that? You won't get one of those.
Yeah.
If a majority of the audience have never pondered on the fact. It's horrible to us, the comics, to think it, but it's happened time and time again in history. I'm not likening, I don't even think comedy is particularly an art. I think we're closer to musical, and I certainly don't think I'm a genius of any sort. I'm just someone who arses around and is a funny person. But if we look through history at some of the things that were written about some of the people we revere now, writers, Charles Dickens, mainstream, penny trash at the time, and now hold up as high art. Mozart, laughed at by Salieri for his obvious chord transitions and his flights of fancy that were emotionally cheap. You can say what you like. The audiences will vote with their feet, and people can sit with their noses in the air as Peter Kay and Michael McIntyre smashes a gig. But you'll be left with your noses in the air in an empty pocket and an empty theatre if your nose stays in the air too long. A comedian needs an audience. And there's definitely a middle path that your Daniel Kitson's and your Stuart Lee's tread, and they're the comedians I love, where they're both achingly cry funny and brilliantly innovative. There's no doubt you can be ground. It's different to be groundbreakingly innovative than to simply be funny in a surprising way that smashes the gig.
Yes.
Not all of us, hardly any of us, will be groundbreakingly innovative.
Did you want to be?
Not particularly, no. I just wanted to be as funny as possible so the audience couldn't breathe, so people had to leave. That's all I've ever wanted to do, where they can't breathe, where no one can be funnier. And so the only thing I'm groundbreaking on, I would say, or the only thing I've got a slight uniqueness on, is my energy. Very, very rarely on a night will anyone light the room up energy-wise than me. I'll very rarely be the most original. And if you wrote it down on paper, I definitely wouldn't be the funniest, and I certainly wouldn't have the best jokes. But I will normally, 95, 98% of the time, have the most energy. And that combined with workably surprising ideas is my can of Red Bull.
Workably surprising ideas. That's a really interesting way of putting it. Like you see your material as good enough to let you ride it brilliantly.
Yes, correct. It's surprising enough. It's not it's not Ross Noble go on and improvise with a badger skin. It's not Stuart Lee take the current political situation and go off on an ad nauseum rant that I would never have the courage to do. It's not Frankie Boyle, I can't believe you just said that about someone with disability and made it funny in a mainstream way. I'm never going to be any of those things. But I do have the most energy, the most enthusiasm, and an ability to sort of find observations in a slightly elevated way. So I'm just slightly in the Edinburgh Ponzi camp, hence the trophies, but mainstream enough to pay the bills.
You got a good place to be. So with that, with the pace, I find it. Do you find that that is? Does the pace and the energy underpin the creativity always? Because you know the way some people, like if they do a funny voice or put on a bit of a character, it unlocks a sort of creative place where they just, you know, the jokes spill out of them. And I would suppose with you it's similar. Like could you come up with 5 minutes on the sandwich if you were operating at a lower energy level? Or does that necessarily...
I'm trying to think of specific examples. So I've got a food poisoning routine, which grew in my normal Darwinian way, I think it's both, to be honest. I think the tags and I've learnt a lot from watching my two masters. And my two masters are as far apart as possible, which not enough comedians do. There's a real problem at the moment with comedians coming through that have watched too much American comedy. If I could tell comedians in their 20s to do one thing now, it's never watch another sentence of American comedy. They don't realise how they look, the sort of slick suit wearing. They're not wearing suits, but they might as well be posturing, rehearsed-ness. It's ruining their original voice.
What do you mean, earnest? Just get into that. What do you mean, earnest?
If your masters are too clustered, you will end up copying.
Okay.
So you want two disparate masters. And if all your masters is... I never know what anyone's talking about in a dressing room. I'm too scared of watching it. That latest Bill Burr special, like, you're from fucking Croydon. What are you talking about? The latest Bill Burr special. It's like, and they're not just watching this shit. They're absorbing it into osmosis. And then they're leaning on the mic stand with a kind of slick type thing. And of course it just doesn't, work. And the worst thing is, you see with some of these, I'm not thinking of a specific comedian here, by the way. I'm just saying generally it's a trend. You can see what you see in the American comedian's head, which the only time I've ever seen it is when I'm in Canada or the North America, the illusion that the gig's going better than it is. I mean, one of the best things about British comics is we think the gig's gone worse than it has, meaning we're always getting better. We're always trying harder. If you go out with a kind of overly long musical sting, thrusting musical tags, am I right, type stuff, I actually am seeing a plague of ironic am I right tags at the end of joke. Am I right? In an ironic American voice. You might be doing it in an ironic voice, but you and I both know you're looking for the am I right genuine point laugh. And it's just what happens is a homogeneity, which is absolute death. Plus, we're not American. We're awkward and English and inward and fucked. So my two masters are completely far apart. They are, he will hate me saying this, Stuart Lee, for dexterousness of thought and ad nauseam pushing past the comfort zone, which I do with my energy, and Lee Max for the funny in the body, funny person, funny look on the face, you just laugh when he opens his eyes, use of body and funny spirit. Those two together are good masters because I don't have anything of what Stuart Lee has, so I need to study the way he uses words to push. That doesn't come naturally for me. So in answer to your question, the food poisoning routine, I'm able to take that on stage with a normal energy and just go, and quite calm for me anyway, not normal calm, but calm for me, go, you know, with food poisoning, there's people who make no noise when they throw up, and then there's the drama vomiters, right? There's the people, you would have lived with one where it's like an exorcism happening in the toilet. And then there's your mate on the dance floor who could have done like three pills and IB for just go in the plant and carries on dancing. That was my starting point.
Yeah.
That was done at a normal energy. The bit that was written by the energy, which is a really long answer for what you've asked me, is when I started impersonating the vomiting. Now, a low energy person, say, I don't know, like a Sean Locke or a Jack D, that can only go so far. Or it might actually, they're too low energy. It would be powerful because of it. But someone in the middle, whereas I'm like a dervish whirling around the stage, my body like a salted slug for 3 or 4 minutes doing this operatic vomerotti. I turn into Italian. I turn into a T-Rex at one point. I turn into James Brown. And it carries on and on and on. That came out of me playing with my energy. But the initial concept could have come with energy or without.
Okay. Great. Another excellent, totally exhaustive answer, Russell.
Exhausting. That's been said many times. Yeah, but I think it's important for newer comics. Try and find someone who you would love to be, who's doing what you do better, Lee Mack, in my case. And then try and find someone you would love to have more of, but is totally different to you. Don't choose someone who's cool and you want to emulate. It's the kiss of death. Most comedians pass through it. It's got to be said. There's some great comics who started young. If you go back, you can see them in their emulation phase, which is, in fact, is an analogous of your whole 20s, comedian or not. Like if you could be a plumber, electrician listening to this. We go through a sort of emulating personality phase in our 20s.
I remember Norman Lovett telling me that Jeremy Hardy used to be a Norman Lovett impersonator.
Emulator.
Way back when.
There you go. But it says have disparate and be cautious with. It's very, very recent thinking American comics are cool. I mean, literally 10 years ago when I won that flaming chalice, the Perrier Award. The reason I call it a flaming chalice is because people then want you to fail because you won it. no one, if you said, oh, if you watched Chris Rock, yes, people heard of Eddie Murphy, yes. Anyone else, if you said it in a dressing room, maybe 1 in 100 people would know you're talking. You know, yeah, Bobby Glitz coming out of LA. You know, what are you talking about, you fucking dickhead? Have you seen Kitson's new show? Do you know what I mean? Why are you talking about a comedian coming out of LA when you've got Daniel Kitson, Stuart Lee, Frankie Boyle, you've got Catherine Ryan here, you've got Hannah Gadsby performing, you've got comedians of colour coming through that are totally original, you've got some great black British comics, and you want to go and watch fucking Chris Rock? Why?
Why not?
What? Because for diversion, yes. Why do I read Jane Austen? I don't want to be a Regency female. I'm able to read Jane Austen without expressing myself like Elizabeth Bennet on stage next night.
But fair enough.
Most comedians in their 20s are not capable of watching. I don't know. I literally don't know the names of these people. Yeah, Donnie Lopez. They can't watch Donnie Lopez's special without being Donnie Lopez the next night on stage. Yes. They just can't do it.
Understood.
So just be careful.
So this is Russell. I'm so excited about his willingness to kind of go there on some of this stuff. I love, as you know, challenging people's preconceptions of themselves, and I love getting into sometimes slightly difficult areas. But Russell is so open and so willing to engage with some of the thornier issues that I raise and will continue to raise over the rest of this interview. I'm really enjoying it, and I'm enormously grateful to Russell for coming onto the show. I really came out of this interview with an even higher opinion of him. So without further ado, I'm not really plugging anything. You can go to comedyinsights.com and you could also go to comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to find out more about things I'm doing. Both of those sites will be gloriously updated. I'm very nearly ready to press go on launching a small private version of the site to just get some feedback from people in an attempt to prolong actually launching it. But I've been building my own one in Wix, which is good. There isn't a code because it's not an advert, but you could probably find a code for something similar by looking around. Now, all I will spruik to you is that you can get in touch at info@comedianscomedian.com. You can tweet me at ComComPod, and you can join the Insiders Club for 25 minutes of extra stuff from this episode at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. You can follow Russell at Russell_Kane or go to russellkane.co.uk, and you can subscribe to his channel on YouTube. And I can't at the moment see whether it's whether his YouTube channel doesn't appear to have a name so much as a discrete combination of numbers and letters, but I think you can easily find it by searching Russell Kane, or indeed Kaneing, K-A-N-E-I-N-G. Really, really fun to look at those. So have a look. And that is all for now. Let's get back to this interview with Russell Kane.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
When you were trying to carve out, when you were successfully carving out an identity as a comic who is different again from all the other white male comics in their 30s. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because you're someone who sort of visibly has been through lots of transformations. Someone in the Facebook group for this podcast, I asked questions for Russell Kane, and someone led me down this path to a clip of you doing a show where you were going around America and you were freestyling with someone and doing lots of weird noises. And I remember that Russell. I remember that kind of like floppy hair, like 90s Russell. I mean, it wasn't the 90s, but that version of you. I remember gigging with you when you were that person. We did some uni gig somewhere, and I remember just like this kind of, we were in a locker room, like that was our dressing room sort of thing, and you were like pacing back and forth, all this frantic energy. And
that would have been about 2007 or 2008.
Fine. Well, I mean, my cultural radar is uncalibrated. It's not calibrated correctly.
But that job you referred to was the one that enabled me to leave work.
Gotcha. As it were. Okay.
But that's the one in the helicopter. I got that audition. I thought, I'm going to try stand up.
Yeah. And it really reminded me that just that tiny clip, it reminded me of just how completely up for everything you were. Like you had this kind of like, he's like, well, let's freestyle. And you're like, sure, I'm going to do that. And I watched it even now going, oh God, that's the kind of thing I dread, that sort of challenge of like, you know, the gauntlet being thrown down and just having to go, yep, I'm the presenter. I'm doing everything like a grown up Blue Peter guy. Like, sure, I'll jump off a thing. What was my question? It's that
transformation.
Well, so that transformation from that to the Live at the Electric you, to the kind of manscaping kind of eyeliner and tall hair, as you kind of move through, you know, your age and life and what you want to express and what have you. I wondered whether you had been consciously kind of branding yourself to stand apart from
Russell branding myself.
Well, you know, it did get a bit virtually. Russell brand for a little bit, you know.
Very.
So we'll just talk about that kind of the different ways you've kind of, because I think more than some comics, your work ethic and your battler, and you want to be the hardest kid on the council estate. And I just emphasize that we're using that as an analogy for being the funniest person, you know.
Yeah, there was no chance of that being the reality.
but that desire, that kind of like really indefatigable kind of battler energy that you have, like you, I felt like you're, I wonder if there was like, I'm getting in the door this way, but I've not quite exploded yet. So I'll look different and I'll aim like this and I'll do what I'm doing, which is be funny and make them get up on their feet and go mad. But I'll do it wearing these clothes or I'll do it like in this thing to try and get to the sort of explosive career that maybe you deserved.
I wish, how much I wish I'd thought of that answer before, because I could have been falsely using it up till now. That sounds amazing. That does sound like such a good explanation for something far shallower that was going on. Okay, the best to be completely honest with these things. So I, like I say, I'm not getting the violin out. My parents didn't divorce. There was always hot food on the table. We had foreign holidays from when I was 11. I had a good, solid working class childhood. We bought our own council house. My dad dug a swimming pool in the back garden. We were a lot better off than a lot of other kids in my council road. Council road is relevant because although my friends are from the estate across the park, a road means that some houses are council owned and some are privately owned. That's what Thatcher did in the 80s. Now, what that means is, as a five-year-old child, as I was, I saw a transformation in my dad from when I was 5 to when I was 15, who went from a council tenant, on, like, i.e. we were in a council house and getting the benefit of a council house, to owning his own house, to sticking pillars out the front of it. It's Brimsdown Avenue, if you want to look at it on Google Maps, you'll still see it now. It's still half council, still half private, still the same. So stick your Google goggles on and have a look at it on Google Maps. Brimsdown Avenue, Enfield. And sure enough, there they are, all standard, boom, 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 terraced council houses, London style, slightly better than Northern style, but still terraced. And then there's ours, four pillars out of the front. My dad wanted Doric Greek pillars, but was told he couldn't have them by the council. We had brick-built pillars, an overhanging porch, doubled the size of the house. We've got four bedrooms, one of which we turned into a giant upstairs bath. Can you imagine an upstairs bathroom? We couldn't at the time. Outside, a dug swimming pool in our massive garden. Some council houses have big gardens, 6 foot deep swimming pool. A gym, only sheet metal built, not what you're imagining, but still a gym. My dad had a workshop. A peacock house amongst the normal houses. That's the way I was brought up. It's a very, even though Enfield technically is not in Essex, as people keep correcting me online, my dad was from Essex, from Barking. We went to Southend every weekend where the beach hut was, and Southend was ended up where I ended up moving when I started stand-up. So I've always felt a cultural affinity to Essex, what a sentence. It's a very Essex thing that's hard to explain without being mocked, but as soon as you've got money, as soon as you're doing well, you want to show off like a dickhead. It's as simple as that. It's base, it's thick, it's crass, it's pretentious. And that is my people. That's what we do. We don't wear a platinum day-date Rolex because it would look stainless steel. So what's the point? Mm-hmm. We would rather wear a gold one with diamonds because more people would notice it and you will look richer and get more attention at the Paul caveman. So we can pretend this is not going on, or we could admit that it is. It's a very sort of squished working class masculinity that's always been squashed, told you're never going to go anywhere, that suddenly gets cash or success or status. And that is all that happened to me when I started dressing like a cunt.
What I'm getting at, I don't refute any of that at all.
And if only someone, I left my management over this, not my management's fault, it's not their job, but I'm with a much more hands-on manager now who's like, comb your hair, that's not appropriate, wear a suit, this is the gig, this is how you need to be dressed, this is what people are saying about you. If only I'd had someone like that quickly that could have just said, back to the dressing room, people have fallen in love with Jenny from the block who talks about his dad and his nan. If you start wearing eyeliner and spiking your hair, it's not that people won't accept that because we're in a creative industry. It's that all the comics and all of the audience will think, well, if this is the real you, was that just an act before?
Yeah,
right. The working class salt of the earth. If makeup wearing goth alternative Noel Fielding you is the real you, like it is the real Russell Brand and it is the real Noel Fielding, if that is the real you, are we just to delete all the stuff we've been putting in our hands and up? Oh, so it's not real then. So what's the new you then? And bang, you start to lose your audience.
Is that what happened? Because from the outside, I didn't see any of that happen. I just thought, wow, he's made an effort in a whole new way.
It's what nearly happened.
Okay.
It was a puncture in the hull of the ship. I was letting on water. I had no idea until a friend, I won't say who, because it's a comedian and they probably wouldn't want me saying, took me aside and explained lying about your age, which I just thought was a normal show. But I've got this thing that makes my skin not wrinkle at a normal rate, so I look a lot younger than my age.
Sure.
But basically, I've got flat feet, stretchy skin, and I don't look 45.
Yeah.
Clearly, I don't. It's not good. It's good that I don't look 45. The rest of it is all negative. I pull muscles all the time. I'm fucked. So I realised I looked 10 years younger than my age, at least, and still do. So I thought, great, not 5 years off. I didn't see what was so controversial. This is showbiz.
You're right. It is showbiz, but it's comedy. And comedy doesn't like a lie, does it?
But we have to remember, I have no comedy friends. I don't sit in the bars after gigs.
Sure.
I don't hang around with comedians. I go in. Mm-hmm. All the comedians like me backstage. I always have nice chats with comedians. No one's ever told me that. That's probably a few people that think I'm a bit irritating. I don't do anything to be disliked. And I was ripping it. The theatres were full. I was all over BBC Three. I had a channel to play with to myself, a corporate work. It was growing, growing, growing. What was there to realise was going to go wrong? But what was, if you think exactly, the ship is the best image. If you think what was happening with a ship, if you're struck in the hull of a ship, you could go for a week letting on water before you start to sink. Someone told me, people are starting to, like, what are, you know, think, you know, what are you type thing. Whereas I was like, look at me, leather trousers. I didn't wear leather trousers. Look at me, my hair. I bet I look really great. I'm going to go on red carpets and wear Cuban heels. And then I'd show pictures to my mates. Look at me, I'm dressed like a punk. Look at all the girls I'm banging. I just thought it was great. It was like being on a merry-go-round. I didn't realise it was calling into question the integrity of the observations and family stories. Never occurred to me.
Is this just based on what one person said to you? Because
it's based on what one person said to me and the disconnect between the growth in my telly work and the growth in my venue size. So I was all over telly.
Yeah.
The comedian, I'm not being ungrateful. The theatre sizes were lovely and they were packed.
Sure.
But they were staying. They weren't going down. My loyal audience were coming with me like some sort of 60-year-old comedian.
Yeah.
So I was stuck at the 500 to 1,000 seater size, which I thought, like, bothered. You do 80 of those dates, that's a lot of fucking money. Obviously, I was doing a lot of telling, a lot of corporate work. I didn't realise the fact of, I am obviously joining these two things and imagining they are. Mm. So then I took external advice from someone else in the industry who I can't name. Someone in management who also confirmed that a few people thought these things about me, that I was having some sort of breakdown, or I was having some sort of midlife crisis, that it was tragic that I was lying about my age. It was a bit pathetic, that it was a bit shallow to put eyeliner on aged 35 when you've never done it before. It doesn't seem like a natural fashion thing. It seems like someone where the attention has got to their head, which was true. That's true.
I'm really struggling. I get where that person's coming from.
Not the pathetic bit, but the attention had gone to your head bit is true.
Yeah, okay.
That's what happened.
Okay. So when you heard that, which is like anyone can wear eyeliner if they want to, but you heard the message, this is a problem in your eye. You've taken your eye off the ball, and that bit did resonate.
Correct.
Yes.
And so then I took, I have to be really careful here because I don't want to get anyone in trouble.
Sure.
But I basically realised that I needed to speak to a manager who would tell me the truth. And would literally go here, do that, dress like that. But legally, you can't do that until you've left your existing management. And I didn't know if I was imagining that, so I took a leap of faith. I had no management at all. Mm-hmm. And then I went to a new one who was as surprised as you are. Everyone I tell this story to is surprised. What? But you were storming. Only a few people who really, really understood comedy knew that if I carried on the way I was going, sooner or later, it would be like a dot-com bubble. It would burst. You know, what's next? Are you going to start going to America or thinking you're a movie actor when you're not? And I realised if I comb my hair now, stick a T-shirt and a suit on and remember what I'm fucking good at, this could go massive. And bang, that's what I did. And that's what happened. You know, now, okay, I'm not doing arenas, but, you know, I start at the 1,000-seater. And that's, in fact, that's big enough for me. And I got my comedy out online. That's helped as well. And it's sort of taken my career to the next stage. Sort of, I would say, top of the championship, bottom of the premiership. And
yeah,
it's still growing.
Yeah, okay. And now it is...
Every tour growing, numbers are growing, another 20%, another 10%, 20%.
And that now is because you are, in part because you are being who you actually are. Like there is, you know, with the caning videos that you do, like there's a lot of stuff which is unmediated. This is just me. You're not 10 years into having big hair thinking, fuck, I've got to put the hair up again.
I'm not using my clothes and my behaviour to try and get extra attention from girls and Heat magazine. I'm just using my brain to be funny. Yeah. I happen to be older now and look a bit different, but I'm dressing in relatively normal clothes. Not in my private life. I still wear stuff that's way too young for me. But on stage, I try to be dressed in a way where a 45-year-old Gary in the audience wouldn't think, can't.
Yeah, fair enough. Did you think, we mentioned Russell Brand, obviously that name comes up with the sort of the visuals and stuff. Given that he is, you know, an educated and articulate working class metrosexual kind of doing big universal things, was there a part of you that was like, when he, I mean, I don't even know the timeline, but I feel like, were you around longer than him and then he overtook you or?
No. He was already very prominent.
He was already prominent.
My first ever gig.
So was there, did you ever have a sense that like who I am deep down is an educated working class metrosexual doing universal concepts? And did you ever think, oh fuck, someone's got to the seat of the table first?
No, I always thought I was high energy, angry, working class, funny person, like closer to sort of Lee Evans, okay, Lee Mack combo. That's all I ever aspired to be or wanted to be. But fashion-wise, I started dating a girl at the time. She was really cool, like punky hairstyle and stuff. And I just thought I'd look cool like that. I wish my thinking went further than that. I would love to say, yeah, I looked at him and I realised that's the type of mess. I just thought, God, but what would it look like if I put a bleach streak in my hair? That looked fucking cool. It was that bad. I've got a first in English, and that's as far as my consideration of the perception of my image went. Weird, isn't it? I thought because it was showbiz, you could do what you want sort of thing. It's rock and roll baby type thing. I didn't realise in comedy there were certain rules you had to follow.
Like what?
To be perceived as having integrity and truth. Because if you lose integrity and truth, then your observations don't pop as much. Didn't realise. It didn't affect the audiences. It didn't affect the live. Like I do, I did a live at the Apollo where I've got my blue pumas on and my spiky hair. It never affected the gigs. I never felt a disconnect between the material. But I'm sure that was coming down the line had I not cut the tumour out when I did.
That's very. That's really straight. I'm absolutely fascinated to hear that because it's not something that I would have guessed at all. And the idea
because I got it early.
Yeah, it's kind of based on part in data and in part on one or two trusted industry people saying
and
this is happening.
And tracking theatre numbers.
Tracking the numbers, yeah.
If I put you on TV doing stand-up 5 nights a week next week with your own BBC Three show and put you Romesh amounts on telly, mm-hmm. and your theatre tickets increased a bit but not massively,
yeah.
what would your conclusion be?
Sure. Yeah, yeah. That it wasn't that I was shedding them somehow.
That you need
failing.
To do something different
connecting.
On... That you need to change the way your mainstream... In the theatre, it's not an issue. People mm-hmm. get the comedy light shines. I couldn't give a shit if you're in a bin bag. Funny's funny. Mm-hmm. But when your TV's a very different medium, and so's online, and if you're putting yourself out there in a pouty, nude selfie, I think I'm good-looking, I think I'm cool type way, you're no longer outside the system mocking. You're within it. Thinking, I'm. You can't go. Oh, here's a nude selfie done for charity, but thinly veiled because I'm currently in shape and want likes for my abs, and think that people aren't going to see through that. Of course, but I did think that people wouldn't see through that, and they did. But the industry saw through it, and people would have followed. So then I found myself in a really interesting position in 2000 and let's say 12. Where I'd realised, gone, shit, met the main part of it was meeting Lindsay, who was like, I really fancy you, but you're dressing like, it looks fucking really weird. Why don't you dress more for a man your age? It'll be sexy. And maybe just make a joke of your age. And so I did a whole show about it. I called Right Man, Wrong Age.
Right.
Biggest okay. selling, the billions, biggest selling show I'd ever done, talking about how pathetic it is, how the vanity and growing up. That's the show I think the routine was from you're talking about.
Yeah, okay.
At the start. So I got rid of all that, talked about it to anyone that had listened, and it stopped people wondering, yeah, you lied about your age. And I go, yeah, currently living off the earnings of it. And that shut everyone up. And so I got to the stage where I was hair combed. I was just still wearing a little black disc earring, but in a nice jacket. And I'm like, well, what do I do now? My management... got me working solid. So I was back on TV. I'm working solid. I'm on TV solidly, sort of the same rate I am now. You see me now and again, I'm on all the time. Now and again, I'm not. Like, I'm on all week at the moment on Channel 4, Steph's Packed Lunch, and then I might disappear, and then I'll come up on something cool, and then I'll do some stand-up thing that's cool. And how did you get there? And then I'll go out on the road. It was, how can I grow it? Because what's happened is I've not lost the people I have. Mm-hmm. I've put off new recruits who've seen metrosexual camp spiky hair. And those new recruits aren't under 29. They are my 25 to 45-year-old married people. They're the people who I relate to because that's my age. I'm talking about having young children. I'm talking about getting married. But they don't think I'm going to be talking about that. They thought, oh, he's probably like the vegan, gender politics, spiky hair, talking about philosophy and Tibet and the Dalai Lama and polysyllables, Russell Brand type stuff. It's not for me. And I'm not. I don't have any of that in my shows. I wish I was that clever. I am. What about when you have a shit and your missus is in the bath at the same time? Who would do that? That's my stuff, but done more cleverly. So how could I bring them in? And I was fucked. I was at a real crossroads. And that's when I had the massive... brainwave in 2012, which 2013, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute, which is going online.
Gotcha. Okay, well, we can talk about both things, because the next thing I wanted to talk about was your connection to your audience. I re-listened to Smoke Screens and Castles, and in that show, it struck, which I thought was brilliant, and like I'd seen some stuff from it around the time of it, but like hearing it all in one go, it's great, and I'd even forgotten or didn't know the ending and the kind of sucker punch ending, and it's a really great show. Throughout it, you pretty continually are saying little disclaimers. Like, you might think this is Ponzi, but it's important to me. This probably sounds daft. This probably sounds ridiculous. This probably sounds sentimental, but this is what I think. And it struck me, like, through. do you recognise that? Do you kind of recognise
that? No, I don't. I'm horrified to know that I do that.
I won't say continually, but frequently. It comes up enough that I noticed it.
It's bet hedging, heading off the critic stuff, I would have thought.
Well, I wondered if it was. Oh, that's interesting. My theory was it was to make sure, in your words, you know, the Garys and the Daves and the Terrys and what have you,
it's not the audience.
To make sure that those people are with you. But it's not.
No,
it was
no, no,
that
no,
was more
fine.
About.
No, it's heading off you lot, the comedians. It's heading off critics and probably some, on some fucked up level, the biggest heading off the internal critic of my dad, the biggest voice in my life.
I mean,
fucking pond, yes. Fucking shit, never achieve anything, life shit, you'll die poor. That was like his album.
Because surely, like the amount of times the weight you've put in the opinion of critics far outweighs the importance of it. And a couple of times you said, oh, what the comics say, but we've established there aren't really, you know, comics aren't getting together to bully you. No, saying anything to your
I've
face.
Never heard
you know,
it. I've never
it's about
it.
That critical voice.
Correct.
It's about that. It's about the critical voice of your dad speaking through all of these other things that could potentially be conceived.
Yes.
Of as critical.
Yes, bullseye. That.
So that show about your dad, you were
ironically
saying you might think this is
ironically the voice of my dad spoiled the whole show.
I mean, it didn't spoil it by any means, but and it does make it palatable. It does. You know, you're continually treading a line between here's a arguably highfalutin concept, and here's just me reaffirming that I'm one of us and I get it. And so you do take people by the hand. It's one of the reasons behind its success. But isn't that fascinating that in that show you're constantly saying this probably sounds ridiculous, Dad, but this is what I mean.
I mean, that is the thing you get with these comedians, these group two comedians who don't have specific wordings for specific routines. None of Smokes and Crossles is not written down anywhere. It never was.
So
there'll be one word
document with
bullet
points. Preconceptions bubble out of it without you being able to stop them.
It's different every night. Some nights I forget the punchlines because the middles of my routines are normally funny. Sometimes I don't. I'm in the car, like, I didn't do the punchline. So I'm not wedded to the wording. So different things will come out each night. And so the fact that the cameras were running was probably why that was even more ramped up to 11, because I knew it was going beyond Southend Theatre.
You can hear that. You can hear that in your voice, and you can hear
the fact
that you're at home, and that you can hear the fact that you're... I think at one point towards the end you even say, you probably noticed I messed up the case. I messed up the present tense there along the way. And I don't want to spoiler it for people who are yet to catch up with that, whatever it is, 12-year-old.
Yeah, that's intentional. that, of course, is intentional for the payoff. But interesting story about... Well, I mean, it's not a spoiler alert. People know my dad's been dead since 2003. It's not a spoiler.
Well, I didn't. I didn't know. I don't know at what point in the show whether he was going to make it through the show or not.
So what happened was I started stand-up with all the normal stuff stand-ups talk about, but in my style. So I got a bit further because I was the energy and the funny, all the stuff we talked about. And then I did before I'd left work, I did a touring show with Russell Howard where I was like the support monkey. And then in the car, everyone was crying, laughing at these horrific stories about my dad and all the weird shit he said. And then on stage, I was doing well, but not as well as I did in the car, making Reginald D. Hunter and Russell Howard laugh. And one day, Russell Howard said to me, "Look, can I give you some friendly advice?" He went, "You're sitting on a gold mine and you're putting silver out on stage. The silver's great. That's your stuff. That is your stuff." I listened to him, but it took me 4 years to listen to him properly because it wasn't until 2010 I thought, he's right, I'm just going to do a show about my dad. The problem was, I'd tested the water in the previous shows with little routines about my dad, but I couldn't work out a way to talk about my dad in the past tense. Every time I did it, so my dad was a lovely guy. The audience were like, oh, his dad's dead. What's the story? There was a little loss of focus. So just for convenience, I spoke about my dad in the present tense. It made it funnier that he was alive. Mm-hmm. People felt like I carried this creative lie. I didn't lie off stage like I did about my age. This creative lie I carried on for so long that I thought, well, does it matter if my dad's alive when I'm on stage? I'll just have an alive dad. I can do it till I'm fucking 60 and my dad would have been, you know.
It's not a dead 90s. Dad show. It's an invincible, an immortal dad show. Yeah.
The stories had, unlike other shows about dead dads that have gone to Edinburgh, my routines had nothing to do about my dad being deceased. They were just funny things working class dad does to fuck you up. Him being dead or alive was neither here nor there. So I thought, keep him alive. The audience is more comfortable and it's funnier to go, do you want to know what my dad's like? This is what he did the other week. It's just funnier because he's alive and we all feel happy. That's how I did the previews for Smokescreen and Castle. That's the way it was until August the 3rd. I woke up, as listeners, I'm sure you know, August the 4th is the first day of Edinburgh. It's the two-for-one day. You do get critics in some night and I'm like, that's the fucking dramatic end. I don't know what made me think of it. I just thought, I'm going to reveal his death at the end of the show and sort of change tense halfway through a sentence under a spotlight, doing his voice. And that sort of bathos might even get people emotional, because I've seen a few comedy shows that got emotional bits and I've never had one. I thought, well, that feels like an arty, theatrical thing to do at the end of a show. I called my agent. I said, she went, that's a really bad idea. You've not tried it. She went, it's a bad idea to gamble. And I went, can you do me a favour and keep press out on the first night? She went, I can't guarantee it. So I got the call at 6 p.m. You got no press in. I thought, well, I'll try it on the first night. What's the big deal? Yeah. I'm really bad at learning stuff because of my Ibiza visiting. And I tried to really, really learn it. Changed my lighting state from my tech the night before for a spotlight. And of course, a few people, girls in the audience, started crying. And I was like, what the fuck? I was like, I'm onto something here. And then that was it. So it's a complete accident on the first day. Didn't preview it, the end bit. That's how that happened. And it was relief, really, to finally be able to go, oh, my dad's dead. And then I got branded as it was like a dead dad show. But the truth was, it was a shallow way of getting a theatrical reaction at the end and having a full stop. So it's out of, like, something you do off a writing course.
Given that we've... It's so funny to hear you kick yourself. It's so... Do you know what I mean? Like, it's funny
That's the honest truth. That's the way it was built. I didn't sit there and go, it needs some bathos. Imagine taking the audience on an emotional journey. That never entered my head. What entered my head was, that's really funny. Imagine if I could do that and maybe they'll, like, cry at the end and that'll be really powerful and look really good.
So with that in mind, and we've established that the voices of other comics are important to you because, you know, they're... The idea of the self-critical voice, the echo that's come up a few times in this of like, other comics might say this.
Yeah.
I've read the transcript of the Stuart Lee bit about your dead dad show, supposedly.
Yes.
Like, because I thought...
I've seen it live.
So to have one of your two masters... who is a comic and speaks through the voice of, you know, the self, speaks in echoes of the self-critical voice that might belong to your dad. Were you able to, like, how did you take that bit? Because I looked at it,
did think it was very funny. The honest truth is I did think it...
I thought it was funny. And I was reading it from the perspective of, is this a personal attack?
Have you seen it performed?
Yes, I have. I've seen it. Yeah.
Then you will know it's... By the way, I'm friends with Stuart. I've been to see his latest show, and we all went out for drinks afterwards and all that stuff. So I don't want to piss him off. I'm not like body shaming him, but he's quite funny to look at now, Stuart. Which
sounds like you're body shaming him, mate.
No. What I mean is, when you watch it, the audience, I'm sure some of the audience are doing middle class laughing at the mainstream Russell shouldn't win the award type laugh, which is what the joke sounds like it's about.
Yeah.
But what this actually is, it's like watching a fat boxer who can't punch anymore get really angry about his punch. You're laughing at the primal, tragic scream of the character of Stuart Lee. Going, give me the award. I should have fucking won that. I'm better than him. Yeah. It's like a sort of combination between a toddler and a middle-aged man. I'm pretty sure that was his intention. Of course you get your cake and eat it as well, and we get to make fun of all the Russells being sort of talentless clones, and there's a bit of that laugh in there. But the majority of the laugh is his impotent wail. That's how I took it.
I totally agree with you, and I'm so glad. I can take a joke. I'm so glad you see it that way and you think, like, that's exactly how I see it. Particularly given that, like, the idea of the sort of the master, the father figure, your father, the criticism, all the rest of it, I was like, oh, that's on a knife edge. You could have really been fucking hurt by that.
Not with humour. With humour, I'm quite sort of like... So when we have writers' meetings, I'm doing a comedy show on the day at the moment, if you can imagine it, on Channel 4 called Steph's Packed Lunch. The first jokes I always throw in the writer's room are ones that you would never guess I've written them. Things talking about you shouldn't be dressed like that, you're pathetic, that joke wasn't funny. They're all my jokes I've given to Steph to say about me. Mm-hmm. I quite like being the butt of the joke. That's what I was like amongst my friends. I don't mind it. I sort of like the attention, really. I find it funny. I do find myself funny. I don't find my joke funny. I find quite a funny object to make fun of. I just do. I've got a good sense of humour with stuff like that. So that's why when people are making fun of me for lying about my age, I sort of want to join in, really. Because I just find it is funny. I always think if it's funny, You've got to be able to take it. I've never understood comedians that can't. The only time I ever would get wound up as if someone saying I haven't behaved properly, like I was mean or sexist backstage or something like that, I wouldn't find that funny, even if the joke was funny. But if someone's saying, just give back your award and fuck off,
yeah,
it's like, it did make me feel a bit like, yeah, but no, I've got it.
Yeah. You did the Hoffman process.
That's right, yeah.
And I only know a tiny bit about that. Callie Beaton did it a little while ago and she was talking to me about it. And the reason it kind of comes up is because you seem, although you're aware of the kind of the critical voice and that, you know, you seem to have a decent amount of self-compassion. You seem happy. I'm really pleased to see you seeming and sounding happy. And then I'd read that you'd done Hoffman. Was that a big part of it? What is your kind of, throughout all of this, what's your kind of mental health journey, to use an awful phrase?
It's two things. Time. I've obviously got my energy thing I'm doing on stage, I should have said that at the top, sadly, is not some sort of theatrical device I've come up with. That is genuinely me plus a coffee. That's how much fucking racing energy goes through my body every day of my life and has done since I was born. In fact, when I was born, I had to be checked over because my hands were permanently forming fists for the first 3 days. They thought I was hyperthyroid, everything was checked. I'm all normal, but something obviously isn't. That amount of, like, the testosterone of 3 bouncers squeezed into a pepperami stick, not good up until about the age of 30. Mm. Way too much energy, too much aggression, not against people, but against yourself. Just easy loss of temper, I would say. I've never done anything dramatic. There's no big reveals here. Just like a constant boiling, running around kettle, just trying to do 1,000, just loads of angry energy. Once I got on top of that, time has helped a bit of that. Being one of the lucky ones who's found, I think people never check their privilege. I am one lucky fucker to have found what I want to be able to do and do it every day at my top performance level. It gets a lot of the anxiety out of your system. You know, so most people don't realise they're supposed to be a chef, or they're supposed to be a painter, or they're supposed to own their own carpentry firm and they should have started when they were 60. They just sort of drift through life without realising there's this space where they can be doing the thing they were born to do at high energy with high engagement and getting results. It gets rid of a lot of shit that we live in a society where I think you need to take a pill for that. I think you need to go and see a psychologist. Whereas if I actually gave you a job you enjoyed and you were doing it till you were knackered each day, you might find a lot of that shit vanish. That said, I did have a problem with a few basic things, door slamming, holes in walls, nothing dramatic. Not strong enough to call it self-harming, but strong enough to say I was punching a wall knowing my fist would probably not be intact afterwards. It was on the border of self-harming. So I wasn't like, cut my arm for attention. I've never done anything like that. But I would definitely headbutt a TV in a temper, knowing full well, probably cut my head open and liking the fact it would, for example. Not every day, probably not even every month. But once or twice a year, something mental like that would happen. Never towards a person. I've never scared a man, or let alone a woman or a creature. I've never harmed anyone. But when it comes to myself, if I couldn't find my car keys, God help the bookshelf, it might get Bruce Lee'd. And I was like, that's not fucking right. It's probably maybe up to about the age of 22. But really, at 30, you're still like throwing your dinner across the wall because you couldn't find your phone. I mean, come on. So I did the Hoffman.
And the Hoffman is, you know, to my understanding, the Hoffman is like a sort of long process where you kind of disappear into yourself for a bit.
Yeah, quite the opposite. It's a short, intense process. 8-day residential, I believe it might be 7.
I was thinking long compared to an hour of therapy.
Yeah, but that goes on for years and years and years.
Okay.
Hoffman is 8 days, done, never go back, no top up, nothing. So it's like an operation. It's short, very short from therapy standards. I don't know any other therapy that lasts 8 days and is finished forever. They take your phone off you. They take books off you. You're not allowed to, literally told not to wank, not to exercise. You're not allowed to sort of get a neck massage of anyone. Nothing at all that would physically divert from the process, which is, and I literally signed an NDA not to do a spoiler alert. Sounds all very Scientology, but it's not. It's based in good old in science. A total assault on the body and emotions. They break you right back down to about 7 years old, build you back up again, and kick you out the door when you go along your merry way. And touch wood, rather than punch wood, I have never had a single, not one single, since 2009, which is when I went, occurrence of any of those behaviours since. Not one. I don't put door slamming or shouting or losing my temper in a normal way. I don't pathologise that. Sure. We all do that, men, women, children. I'm talking about punching a hole through a wall or breaking something to feel better about a situation. That's weird. I don't do any of that anymore. Never have.
That's great. So that's great. And
I can recommend
the NDA there that you've signed is a lovely little shield against further investigation of that. I want to respect you.
It's because the reason for the NDA is there's physical aspects to the process. People want to lay in a couch while someone with a degree tells them what to think. It just doesn't work. It's not shocking enough. If I hit you in the face with a plank and break your jawbone, that scar will be there forever. They hit you in your mind with a plank and change the bits that need to be changed. If you do not get hit hard enough and go in and tear open and do an operation, it's close to hip replacement. You can't go and see a physiotherapy for a hip replacement. It will not fucking work. You've got to cut open, replace the hip, stitch it up, go back out the door. It's close to that. There's physical elements to it. There's an American-y, cringy, fuck ever doing that again bits to it. There's group elements bits to it. You don't even get your own bedroom, even though it's about $6,000 for the week. I've never shared a room with another man in my life. There's all these things which break down your walls. And yeah, you're right. Sure enough, right at the core of mine was the nagging negative voice of my dad. So, that's different for everyone. So I'm not spoiling anything by revealing that. So I fixed that. And after that, what show did I write? Smokescreens and Castles. Next year, literally 6 months later, I did a show called Stupid Man Smartphone, a survival show. And I completely sorted out the combed hair, wear a suit, TV work was cooking, everything was back online. And I was like, how can I go back to dramatically growing my reach? Because I know my stuff is disappointingly universal and vanilla and I want people to hear it. I want to be mocked by other comedians for being obvious. That way you know you're getting it. You know you've got a swimming pool indoors when you're being mocked for being obvious. And I thought, how can I remind people that I am doing family universal stuff? And I was doing a survival with a YouTuber and he said to me, Stuart Weiss, he said to me, why don't any of your lot, meaning us, meaning old school analog, save up your material, sell it to Apollo once a year. Why don't we ever just switch on a camera and put stood up on the spot, properly performed, stand up down a webcam or a phone camera online dropped? Why is it never? And I checked, not one comedian on the planet, not one in any country, America or UK, none were doing it on Facebook or Instagram. Not one. Why? Obvious. Material is precious. If we give it away online, we can't perform it on stage. Oh, that's why YouTubers can do more banal stuff like open a present and be vaguely witty. But you go past that, you hold it, you make a lot of money. He said, no, you missed my point. You know all the stuff in a preview that, oh, that's quite good, but not quite good enough. He said, just do me a favour when we get back from this survival trip. And we was knee deep in snow when he told me, 17-year-old kid, do a 3-minute video with your B stuff that's not good enough and dies on stage. I did it. 70,000 people watched it. And I think I sold 200 tickets off the link I put on it. I was like, fuck. Then the next week, I did something that was really topical. And it was funny for a few nights on stage, but I knew wouldn't be the next week. So I could only use it. And I wasn't on Mock the Week that week. I wasn't Have I Got News For You. And I was able to get in there first, before a news quiz, before all those programmes. 70,000, I was like, shit. Then I did one that 300,000 people watched. And I've done it ever since. I call them canings. And once a week I do it. Obviously, everyone's doing it now in lockdown. Fair play to them. But up until 2018, I was still, according to Facebook, who I went into their headquarters and met with, the only stand-up on the planet. Plenty of stand-ups doing funny sketches, funny blogs, laying back on the sofa, being funny. No one stood on the spot, not professional comedians, I mean, stood on the spot, performing as though doing stand-up, cut and dropped, still none. And I used that to join the online world with the analog world. Now, plenty travel in the other direction. They come from YouTube and Instagram and influencer onto stage. None go, I'm on stage, I really fancy being layman online. None. Because it sounds like an idea that doesn't make sense. Any newer comics, next time you have an idea that doesn't make sense and sounds shit, I advise you to do one thing. Try it. And then don't do it again if it really is shit. Because 1 out of 10 of those, you'll end up doing something that no one else does and you'll have more bums on seats. And that's what it's about, making people... If you're passionate about stand-up, that is all you should give a fuck about.
What an episode. Jesus, thank you, Russell. That was
I bet there's some backlash from that, I bet. Yeah. You.
I'll get it out quick before you can change your mind.
It's too on it. Like I said, I'm honest. And there wasn't enough thinking in my life where there should have been more. And some things were overthought where there should have been less.
But better to be in a position now where you took the risks and got to a, you know, you made the decisions you did and got to a position of success whereby you can look back and go, that was a mistake, than to have been too reticent, or is it, I don't know if reticent is the right word, too cautious and maybe not.
And also, it sounds so banal, but meeting the right woman at the right point is important because she literally said, you look like a fucking dickhead, sort your life out. It's very powerful. Someone whose bra you want to take off on a regular basis tells you to wear different clothes, you do it.
And I think that is the real lesson that we've all learned here today. So that was Russell. Really grateful to him for coming on the show. Thank you for listening. I enjoyed that one enormously. Follow Russell at Russell_Kane or go to russellkane.co.uk. And if you'd like to know more about the Canings on YouTube, then search for Russell Kane in the YouTube search bar. 25 minutes of extras, including incredible advice for comics who are considering following in Russell's footsteps, performing live stand-up on YouTube. If you're thinking about doing that, don't miss the extras for this. And also some thoughts on a kind of... not exactly a war, but a kind of a stubborn digging heels in situation that Russell got into, kind of using a particular piece of criticism or the work of a particular critic as kind of grist to his creative mill. So all of that, comedianscomedian.com/insiders. For much more, all of the extra content from every episode that has it, including the recent exclusive Insiders Q&A with Mr. James Acaster, all of that is there. No postamble today. This is a re-record of a lost file. So I'm completely out of time for postambling. Apologies. But if you would like to find out about my virtual office party, now available as the perfect solution to remote working, office parties, sales conferences, motivational well-being events, stuff like that, if you're a corporate bod, then I can tell you that the following quotes are real. The games and interactive element were hilarious and extremely well executed. 10 out of 10 from us. You created a real buzz in our business. Thank you. And it was an absolutely hysterical and wonderful evening for both those partaking and everyone watching online. It's bloody good and I'm having loads of fun doing it. So go to virtualofficeparty.co.uk or go to comedyinsights.com to find out about what I can offer your business. That's an odd sentence, isn't it? I'll find a less corporate speak way of saying that. But it is true. I can offer your business a thing if you have one. So get in touch about that. At ComComPod on Twitter, comedianscomedian.com for everything else. And please join me in thanking Russell Kane. Join me in thanking. I'm so desperate to be on a stage. That's what I normally say at the end of a night. Join me in thanking Russell Kane. Your editor was Nathan Wood. And Jake Crossland did the logging as ever. Your podcast consultant was Peter Dobbing. And the music was by Rob Smouten. Thanks, everybody. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. Enjoy your week. Next week, Bethany Black. And then after that, we've also got a fantastic... That's an absolute cracker. And I've just finished recording now a brilliant episode with Olga Koch. So both of those to look forward to as well. And that crying baby in the background means it's time for me to get out of here. Bye for now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.